Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts, sports journalist David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves, chillin', talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. He's Dave Bryan of SteelersDepot.com, the place to get your latest and greatest Steelers information. And I'm David Todd. It's Season 8, Episode 56, and it's Ravens Week and a quick transition for the Steelers, obviously, with a game Monday night and then coming back at Heinz Field, a game Sunday night against another divisional rival, the Ravens, Dave. And, of course, we go back-to-back here. We're going to have our buddy John Eisenberg join us, who covers the Ravens for Ravens.com, coming up in a little bit. But, of course, yesterday Ben Roethlisberger spoke and Mike Tomlin spoke, and most importantly, updated us on the condition of Ryan Shazier. And we don't know a ton more than we did 24 hours ago, but at least things seem to be trending positively, I guess, from certainly obviously the worst-case scenario.
Yeah, and that's the way I took it as well, too. The last, I guess, kind of official update was from, you know, I guess you'd say Ryan himself. He did tweet out last night, you know, thanking everybody for their thoughts and prayers and all like that. So that's obviously a positive, you know, I think in itself. And then, you know, the team, there was a kind of a joint, I guess, statement, if you will, from the doctor at the Cincinnati Medical Center, along with the I don't want to get
one of the Steeler guys, of the Steeler doctors.
Yeah, and I don't want to mistitle what his specialty is or anything like that. But I assume, you know, along the lines of neurological or something along those lines. But anyway, a joint statement that he was going to have to stay overnight at least, you know, the next 24 to 48 hours in Cincinnati for more tests and all like that. And then hopefully, you know, either today now or tomorrow, you know, he will be, you know, moved back to Pittsburgh there. So, people still kind of want to speculate, I guess, as to you know, what's the short-term and long-term prognosis on Ryan Shazier. And, you know, I'm afraid to do such a thing right now. The biggest thing is, man, let's make sure he can get, you know, he's walking, can get out of the hospital and all like that before we go any further here. And, you know, we'll have to see what the Steelers do with him as far as, you know, administrative with any kind of a roster move. You would think nothing would be done this week. I mean, unless they know something that you know, a few of us don't right now. So, I don't want to speculate on him, but look, Vince Williams seems to be upbeat about the news that he's hearing about Ryan Shazier. As I mentioned, Ryan Shazier tweeted last night, and the things that Mike Tomlin had to say. And look, Mike Tomlin, you know, say what you will about Mike Tomlin, that was a quick night for him, right? I mean, he had to go after.
Sure. Had to go to the hospital.
Right, he had to go to the hospital, and then I assume fly back on you know, a different plane other than a team, along with, I guess, Colbert and Art Rooney II, and you know, probably not much sleep last night. Then gets up and has to do a press conference, you know, Tuesday, and you know, I thought he was on top of his game.
Yeah, I agree. I think he was very good, and. Look, I think Mike is generally very good about dealing with stressful, high profile, high danger situations, for lack of a better term. And I thought he was direct. The one thing he always is, and I give him a ton of credit for it, is he's always direct. There's a great deal of transparency in, you know, it's very clear that he's giving you the information that's pertinent. Does that mean he divulges every single, you know, nuanced detail of every situation? No, of course not. But, you know, he talks about, you know, he was asked repeatedly how he felt about the situation. And as he so often does, he deflected all of those conversations. It's not about me. It's about Ryan. I'm not looking for comfort. We hear that line from him repeatedly in various situations, whether it be related to football or some other activities. And that was one of his go-tos again yesterday. But yeah, he gave us the update on Ryan. And, you know, it seemed, you know, in hindsight now, it did seem a bit, maybe a bit optimistic that he would be moved from Cincinnati to Pittsburgh, you know, within 24 hours of the accident. And that would have been great news. Obviously, they kept him another day for precautionary reasons, more tests. None of us know kind of where this is going to go. But hopefully, if he's able to be moved to Pittsburgh today, again, that would be a positive sign that, you know, he's able to be moved. And you know, how he is moved will give us some more indication about where things stand. So, yeah, we don't know a lot more than we did yesterday when we did the podcast. So that's the one situation. The other is, and we didn't get a ton of insight, but Tyler Matakevich is injured. And Dave, give you props yesterday for the suggestion that the Steelers might go to Sean Spence as a possibility when we laid out kind of the different alternatives the Steelers might have with two of their inside linebackers down. And that's exactly what they did, re-signing Sean Spence to the roster. So it's very clear that Ryan Shazier is not going to be playing football this weekend. And I would be very surprised the way Matakevich went off the field and with Mike's talk yesterday that if he's available to the Steelers. So there's still going to be a roster move here. And with the Juju news, that's probably how that's going to play out.
Yeah, and the thing is now with Juju, of course, we'll get into this a little bit more, I'm sure, here in a minute here, talking about Juju and his appeal. Boy, that was – I wonder how long that appeal lasted. I'm guessing it was some sort of a video chat that he had with James Thrash and all like that. I imagine that whole thing lasted maybe 5-10 minutes, and it sure didn't seem like it took James Thrash long to issue his decision and deny it, and thus Juju's going to have to serve that game suspension this week against the Ravens. That, of course, Juju going to the reserve suspended list for one game opens up the roster spot for Sean Spence. So that's kind of cut and dry right there. Now back to Tyler Matakevich. I saw when he went off the field, David, but I didn't actually see what had happened, and Alex was able to pick it up last night on the All 22 film, sort of from the end zone view of the play that when Tyler went off. To me, man, it looked very similar to the way Stephon Tuitt was injured last year. There really was no hard, brutal contact on the play. It looks like he's reaching to maybe fend off a block from an offensive lineman running across the field there, and then all of a sudden he grabs, you know, he kind of lowers and he grabs almost like his arm went dead. So it makes me wonder, David, if that isn't a biceps injury or a triceps injury with Tyler Matakevich. So Mike Tomlin, of course, still referenced it as a shoulder. To me, there was just nothing that happened, you know, physical that would make you think, okay, separated shoulder. The way he kind of grabbed at his arm and then kind of cowered off lowered and went off the sideline really makes me wonder if it isn't a biceps or a triceps. But regardless, I at this point, the way he did go off and was holding that and all, I would be surprised if he plays against the Ravens. So the question then becomes, you know, is he injured seriously enough to go on IR? And if not, you're obviously probably going to need, you know, one more. I guess you could get away with letting Arthur Motes have some reps at inside linebacker this week as a number four guy, but you know, in doing so, you would probably have to dress James Harrison. Where I haven't really gone through the full list of what the inactive list may or may not look like just yet. But really, the other option that you have later on in the week, if you're wanting another inside linebacker that can play on special teams, is perhaps you call up a guy like Keith Kelsey off of the practice squad on, let's say, Saturday, And then you do maybe a turnaround with him if you think there's a chance that, Tyler Matakavich, you know, will only miss one game. So it'll be interesting to watch the injury report this week. You know, obviously, I think both of us agree, you know, Ryan Shazier and Tyler Matakavich will be on the Wednesday offering as did not practice. Antonio Brown, let that guy do whatever he wants. Tells you that he wants to do this week, so it wouldn't be surprising for him to show up on the injury report this week. Mike also hinted at some bumps and bruises that, you know, participation will obviously be a guide with those guys. We'll see what happens with Mike Mitchell. We'll see what happens with Vance McDonald. Man, Vance McDonald's just turning into Ladarius Green Part 2, except a different type.
Yeah, he's
type of injury.
He's not going to go in this one with no practice again last week and a short, you know, a short week coming back. I'd be shocked that, you know, he just, you know, steps in and goes. So it has been disappointing. You know, we saw Grimble be, you know, an active target three different times, almost made a spectacular catch down the seam in the game on Monday night. But yeah, that's the Steelers have made the move, and we've now seen. Hawkins is a guy who's taken that step forward. I mean, essentially, this is his rookie year. And while, you know, there was effusive praise for him in his initial preseason before he got injured and then put on the IR for the entire season last year, the reports on Hawkins weren't particularly effusive. And so, you know, you looked at the depth chart and wondered where he was. Was he eighth? Was he ninth? Was he a guy who was going to go early in the season? Was he going to go to the injured reserve with the knee injury? Well, you know, this is a story that obviously on the list of Steelers stories of the season is about 50th down the line. But, you know, the positive here is that, the fourth round pick from 2 years ago may be taking some strides forward. And when you think about offensive line depth going forward, the Steelers have some guys, and I think they like the guys that they have, and this is a nice addition if he is to kind of live up to the initial billing that they had. Remember, he came out a year early as a junior at LSU, and you know, just kind of something to file away in the back as you think kind of going forward. Obviously, we'll get into all this stuff in free agency and the draft about kind of positions of need.
Yeah, and it was a shoulder injury with him, David, with Hawkins last year.
Right, shoulder injury last year, and then discussion early in the season with his knee injury, would he go on IR?
Right. And let's see, he played, what, 5 snaps in his first game that he dressed for, and I think he played 5 more snaps against the Bengals as well. So I think we have 10 snaps or 13 snaps or something like that to go on. He did run one route and was open against the Bengals as well. So that's obviously not something you're going to see a lot of, but sometimes when you have that extra tight end, you're going to have to do some things, or extra tackles a tight end, you're going to have to do some things like that maybe to keep some teams honest there. But here's the positive. He's on the field. And he's getting snaps, and I think he's even said this this whole new end of the line, you know, tight end stuff is kind of new to him. One would think that he's going to dress again against the Ravens with Matt and let Matt Filer be inactive and kind of do some of the same things. But boy, they could use a healthy, you know, Vance McDonald back. We'll see what happens with Mike Mitchell, as I said as well. Look, I mean, this inactive list is probably going, you know, depending on what happens with Matakavich and Shazier, whether or not either of those two are placed on IR, I doubt that's going to happen this week. So you already have Dobbs, you have Filer, you have Tyler Matakavich, you have Ryan Shazier. That's 4 of your 7 inactives right there. Justin Hunter's not going to be on your list this week with Juju suspended, so he's going to be active, one would think.
All the DBs will be active. All the linebackers will be active. So,
right.
You know.
McCullers, I guess, would be on the list as number 5. Who else you got?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it would be a question mark, but now between
McDonald's.
You know, maybe it's McDonald 6 and then Mitchell and Brian Allen, with Cam Sutton getting playing time, he'll have moved ahead of Brian Allen for sure. So maybe, you know, if Mitchell goes, maybe Allen doesn't. And if Mitchell can't, maybe Allen gets a helmet.
Yeah, and if both Mitchell and Allen are healthy, though, I think both those guys dress, because Allen's been playing a lot of special teams, punt coverage stuff and all like that. So I would kind of doubt that that he would be down. So if Mitchell dresses, I hate to say it, maybe James Harrison doesn't dress again. Especially if you look, we'll have to see what happens with Keith Kelsey. If somebody comes up, if somebody gets promoted from the practice squad, they're dressing. Okay, so that means somebody's got to sit again, and it might be James Harrison again. But we'll see what the injury report says starting later on this afternoon. And the way Mike, I guess the way we kind of got on this was the way that Mike Tomlin worded it, with bumps and bruises and participation. There might be a surprise name or to look. I mean, even Ben Roethlisberger might show up on that thing today, because he took. He took a couple of pops in that game, landed on a shoulder. I think one time I even saw him grab towards his ankle one time. So it wouldn't be surprising if Ben Roethlisberger was on the injury report today as well. And Sean Spence just already had a question this morning on Twitter from somebody saying, you know, will Sean Spence get more snaps than a guy like LJ Fort? Look, I doubt it. Now, I think at best case scenario, there's some situations maybe where Sean Spence gets on the field for a few snaps on defense, but in one short week, barring injury, I personally would be surprised if Sean Spence is anything more than a special teams player. Right out of the chute here right now.
There's a reason LJ Fort's on the team, and there's a reason, you know, he's been part of the defense and got some activity. So yeah, you know, if the Steelers thought Sean Spence was, you know, a guy who was going to make their team better a week ago, then Sean Spence would have been on the team. So he wasn't. So he's not going to move ahead of anybody on the depth chart. Now, does that mean, you know, in a certain situation he couldn't get on the field? No, there could be a, you know, maybe they work him in, you know, in practice on some special situation that they feel like he has a, you know, maybe a third and long situation. They want to go and use his athleticism in a certain way. It's a possibility, but I'm with you. I'd be surprised if he got any defensive snaps, and he's probably not even kind of going to be first special teamer initially. But if they need bodies in that area and feel like they'd rather use him and rest Fort if he's going to be starting on special teams, or have him fill in for Matakevich ahead of somebody else, then that's certainly a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's see, where else do we – what else did Mike Tomlin have to say?
Yeah, so, you know, Mike just talked about the result of the game and, you know, just kind of where things are. You know, let's get to the Juju thing. And look, the videos are up there. There's a very good one up on Steelers Depot that the guys put up where if you look at it, it's the reason this video is so good is it is just the hit. And it's very clear to me that Juju and Vontaze Burfict are almost exactly on the same plane. And the reason I bring that up is because in the language used by the NFL in handing down the suspension, they talked about the two events that were both penalized. And there are a couple things about this we'll get to. But the point is that they talk about it was a blindside hit. It put the defensive player at risk, and it was unnecessary. Well, there are a couple things here for me. And if I were the lawyer arguing the case for Juju's appeal yesterday, which was obviously, if you haven't heard this, and we mentioned it up top, the appeal was heard and Juju lost the appeal. So he will serve the suspension against the Ravens. Is Burfict, as is every guy who's trying to make a tackle, is focused on the ball carrier. Right now, if there's, you know, if you've got shrapnel on the way to getting a ball carrier, obviously your eyes have to deal with blockers in front of you, and you do that. But Burfict is basically a linebacker coming from inside, as is Bell, the running back, coming from inside. So they're kind of on parabolic kind of curves, where Burfict's obviously got to make a judgment: where can I intercept the ball carrier, right? I mean, it's just, it's a standard football play, but we don't use this kind of language or think about it this way because we don't have these situations to talk about it. So Perfect is angling toward Le'Veon Bell to make a tackle. Bell is kind of bent, you know, bent from the backfield trying to come around the right edge. And as Perfect is going, Juju, who's lined up outside to the right and has moved forward a couple steps from the line of scrimmage, then moves to his left to find a defensive player to block for Bell. If you watch it, basically the two or three steps they each take before making contact, they are on the same yard line, more or less. I mean, you know, they're within kind of a foot or a couple feet of the yard marker as they move to the collision point, the mesh point, if you will. And Perfect, his head is turned because Le'Veon Bell's coming from upfield. If you know, from the Steelers' backfield is where he's coming from. So naturally, he's running a direction, but he's not staring exactly at the forward that the direction he's running. His head is tilted 45 degrees, turned 45 degrees toward the ball carrier. This is 100% natural. There's nothing out of the ordinary in Perfect's movements or actions as he's going to make the tackle. Juju comes down the line, and obviously we all know what happened. He squares him up. He crushes him. He gets some contact with the head and neck, and as Dave and I have said a million times, penalty deserved by the reading of the rule book. He committed a violation. I don't, you know, a couple of people have argued that point, but I think it's generally accepted that that's a penalty. And then, you know, he stands over him and he gets another penalty. I think that's generally accepted as well, even though the entire time that he stood over Vontaze Burfict was probably maybe 2 seconds. He did stand over him, kind of took a step on top of him, glared down at him or looked down at him, whatever verb you want to use. And before David DeCastro kind of moved him off and he got off. It was all very quick, but all legit. And the reason both penalties weren't enforced is they made the ruling, which, you know, if you're a Bengal fan, you probably don't love the ruling. But they made the ruling that the taunting penalty occurred during the play, so it wasn't a dead ball foul. So only one of the two penalties could be enforced. So they accepted the taunting penalty. If it had been a dead ball foul, they would have had the, like against in the playoff game between the Bengals and the Steelers, where Perfect got the whoever I think it was Perfect got the second penalty after the with Joey Porter after the play was over. Then you get 30 yards of penalties. In this case, you only get the 15 yard penalty. So to you know, wrap it up, the point is, in the language that the NFL used in handing down the suspension, they called it a blindside hit. And to me, it's just disingenuous to use that term for the hit that Juju put on because Perfect's head was slightly turned in an angle as he tried to make the tackle with the ball carrier. Look, there's a book. We talked about the blindside tackle. That's the guy who is guarding the quarterback whose back is turned to that side. This is front and center, square in the chest. So, you know, that's my problem with the whole thing. The fact that they added the taunting aspect to the handing down of the penalty, that to me is an NFL first. No guys, in my knowledge, has ever, you know, you can be reproached for taunting or fined for taunting, but it has never, taunting is not a player safety issue. No player has been injured by another player taunting them. And so to throw that in as part of the reason for the suspension, to me, again, it's, I don't know that it's grasping for straws, but it's doing something. There's no precedent, as far as I can remember, of taunting being used to suspend a player. So Juju gets suspended for what I didn't think was a blindside hit, but it was a hit that deserved an infraction. And then on top of that, they included the fact that he was unsportsman in delivering the hit action as part of the reason for the suspension. And to me, you know, it's just they got it wrong. To me, they got it wrong.
And in that letter that was released yesterday, it states, violated Rule 12, Section 2, Article 7, which prohibits unnecessary contact. And this is a key string of words here. Unnecessary contact against a player who is in a defenseless posture. And Rule 12, Section 3, Article 1, which prohibits unsportsmanlike conduct. The main part, Rule 12, Section 2, Article 7, is what we hope, was the reason why he got the suspension and not the unsportsmanlike conduct. Now, John Runyon goes on to write. I didn't know he was in Congress either. Did you know that? Did you know John Runyon was what is he, a representative or something? Did you know that?
I guess I threw this. I knew that. I don't know if I knew it before.
Okay. He writes, "You are suspended for the dangerous and unsportsmanlike acts you committed during the fourth quarter of last night's game, specifically with 7:10 remaining on a passing play to a running back. You lined up a defender and delivered a violent and unnecessary blindside shot to his head and neck area." I agree with the neck and head and neck area, and then, of course, celebrated play, blah, blah, blah. I guess the definition of blindside is what you are having the biggest issue with, David?
Yes.
I think it was blindside. I don't, you know, I think blindside is kind of a loose term here, if you will, because I don't think Burfict saw it coming. I think even though he was running the direction really close to the same plane as Juju, I still think he was blindsided, quote unquote, you know, by the hit. That's why I think because if Juju would have, boy, can you imagine if Juju would have went low and same plane, same everything, and went at Burfict's knees, and I mean probably would have torn him up very, very bad, put him out for a season. That hit would have been deemed legal, right? Correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then, of course, if he tears up his knee, then you want to talk about people having issues then. He committed a non-legal football act without the intent to injure, in my opinion. Face it, if he's 4 inches lower with that shoulder head, you know, there's no issue at all. The fact that the reason the blindside terminology plays into this, in my opinion, is it plays into where he hit Burfict at, if that makes sense. But regardless, I think it was rightly penalized. As I said the other day, I thought it was rightly penalized. Both of them rightly penalized. The optics obviously weren't great with Juju standing over him. It still makes me wonder if James, you know, the appeals officer James Thrash said, "Look, you know, maybe we would have something here if you didn't stand over him." You know, I wish they could separate the church and the state in that matter, but probably didn't. But when you compare that though to what Rob Gronkowski did, and I know it's two different things, but you know, I'm just making a point here. What Rob Gronkowski can each guy get a game? Does it seem fair for each guy to get a game when one is committing a non-legal football act without the intent to injure, while the other one is committing a non-legal non-football act with the intent to injure? Did that come out right?
Yeah, you said it right. Look, here's the only thing, and it's obviously that thought has been rampant across Twitter. And here's the only way I can explain it is if you in Major League Baseball you play 162 games, and obviously a guy can get suspended for 1, 2, 3, 5, 7 games. You know, don't see much beyond that. But the point is, they can gradate differences and not have a massive impact on the season. Every NFL game counts for, you know, a little over 6% of the season. One baseball game counts for, you know, less than 1% of the season. So you can have fine gradations. And it, just in weather terms, if I were going to say 20 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit is cold, 40 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit is mild, and 60 to 80 degrees Fahrenheit is warm, the NFL doesn't have the gradations in between. So Gronk might be at 90 degrees and it's warm, and Juju might be at 61 degrees and we're still calling it warm because it's a one-game suspension, because every step you take there is a massive movement because there's so few games. Of course the actions were completely different. Now remember, the other thing is Gronk is getting he's going to get fined by the league, and he's also going to lose his game check, which is $260,000. If you go another game on Gronk, you've now put over a $500,000 fine on him. And as egregious and, you know, wrong as his actions were, then you have to start to say, you know, does that penalty fit the crime of what happens in the NFL on the playing field? And the answer is no. In my mind, it's clearly no. What he did is wrong, but does he deserve to be fined $500,000 and miss more than 10% of the season to take that next step of a two-game suspension? So the problem is more with kind of the NFL and the few number of games that are played. And so I just think I understand people equating the suspensions, but that's why that's the answer. It's just a much more difficult thing. Now they could raise the league fine on him from, you know, $30,000 to $100,000, and I guess that's impactful. But I'm not at all surprised. I think the mistake was suspending Juju, not suspending Gronk more.
David, look at my Twitter feed right now. Did you see the hit by Julio on the safety that I just put up?
Yeah, I'm watching it right now.
People are clamoring of why that didn't.
Well, he didn't hit him in the head.
Right. Hey, look, much. I think a much. If you and you can pause that if you click on the animated GIF right at the right time, you can pause that right at contact time. For one, Julio, very. I mean, it's a lot. You can see it a lot more in detail, turns his left shoulder and lowers his head and strikes. And Sendejo kind of turns in his right shoulder right at the moment of impact here. Is it borderline? Absolutely it is borderline.
Borderline what?
Borderline a legal blindside hit.
So a penalty.
So a penalty.
Not a suspension.
Well, I mean, why?
Let me ask this question. Do we think Juju would have been suspended if he didn't stand over him?
Part of me thinks him standing over him played into his suspension. If that happened, then it's wrong.
Right. And they wrote about it, so it must have. I mean, I agree with everything you just said. I think it played in, and it should not have.
Right. And it's unfortunate. I don't know. I mean, how do you take the wording? It says what Runyon wrote. He says, you are suspended for the dangerous and unsportsmanlike acts committed during the fourth quarter. So it's both. It's the dangerous and unsportsmanlike acts that he committed during the fourth quarter of last night's game. So, you know, if he doesn't stand over him, is he playing against the Ravens?
Yeah, you know, I think he would have. I think he would be. So that's just, you know, personal opinion is you know, they got it wrong. So look, I mean, Malcolm Floyd laid a block out in the Patriots game last year. You know, when he was after he was waived and then signed by the Patriots, where he cleaned a guy out. It was a celebrated hit. As you know, as violent as you will see. And it's, again, for me, somebody, we mentioned this on yesterday, you know, defining crackback, blindside, all these different things. There's a lot of gray in kind of how that's defined. It's not been, you know, for me, it's never been all that easy to exactly delineate where these things are. So, okay, we probably shouldn't spend the entire show talking about that.
I one more question on this.
Sure.
Should Julio be fined?
Well, okay. So was this this week?
Yes, that was. It was in the game this weekend, right? The
yeah, they played each other. Yep. No. I think it was. Look, I don't think. Again, I didn't think Juju's hit was a blindside hit. He deserved the penalty because of the contact with the head and neck area. It was not a finable offense for Juju in my mind. If, again, taunting is not something that we've seen players get suspended for. Again, if you want to throw the two of them together and fine him, I wouldn't have raised an issue with that. I do not think Julio Jones should suffer any punishment.
We'll see by the end of the week, right? We'll know by Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday, if Julio gets fined.
Right, and he's obviously more likely to get fined because of Juju's actions, ironically.
And you would think the decision's coming. Just because we don't know it yet doesn't mean that he hasn't already got the letter on Tuesday, right? So it just might take a few days for this thing to filter out to the media and all as well or not. So hold your horses on the Julio hit. But even so, I think the way he lowers his shoulder and hits him, it's blindside, but it goes back to what you and I just said, blindside and where. I think that's the biggest aspect of these hits. You can blindside a guy and hit him in the knees and ruin his, ruin his career, and that's not a penalty. But if you hit him up near the head and neck area, and he's blindside, well, you probably deserve a penalty and a fine there. All right, what else we got moving right along?
Okay, so Iloka I don't want to say he's collateral damage. I mean, this whole thing, they're both collateral damage in my mind. Iloka's hit definitely deserved a fine, no doubt about it. But again, we've seen guys hit guys in the head, intentional or not. Mike Mitchell made a bit of an impassioned tweet in defense of George Iloka. We both said yesterday that we considered him a hard-hitting player, a physical safety, not a dirty player. Kind of Mike Mitchell reiterated that view as a guy who knows him, has played with him. Okay, fine. So, if they're not two instances, maybe they're no instances. But it was a little bit of take a pound out of each. And, I think it's a legitimate question is the NFL making an example of this game? And it's hard not to think the answer is yes, with the kind of the overreaction of McDonough and Gruden on the television broadcast, the kind of just the tweets on social media and the conversation around the game. They're not the optics the league is looking for. They continually, it's low-hanging fruit, sometimes deserved. There's nothing easier than taking shots at Roger Goodell. So this is a situation where they felt like they had to take action, and they did. I honestly believe that both guys who got suspended are somewhat collateral damage to all of this.
You think because the game was Monday night, in other words?
Yeah, nationally televised Monday night. Yeah. The broadcasters going Gruden calling it disgusting, and kind of, people like Troy Aikman, who was mentioned in the press conference, kind of chiming in that it's a negative optics type of situation, and the NFL's pandering a bit to, I think, what was public reaction.
Yeah, you might be right. Yeah, I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about that. But, regardless, they're not – like I said the other day, they're not flexing any Ravens, Steelers, Bengals, Steelers games out anytime near future, even if the teams – one of the teams has no wins. It's going to be – look, the ratings was evidently up for Monday Night Football as well, something I read last night. Shall we talk a little bit more about what happened between the white lines that was legal?
Yeah, look, this is a really an impressive win is probably the best adjective I can come up with it. The Steelers were able to put 3 points on the board at the end of the first half. That was significant in hindsight. That was a big deal on literally two plays. The terrible defending by the Bengals again. That's always part of the equation, allowing Bell to go 33 yards on a second down screen pass from inside his own 20 to get to midfield. And then AB being able to win deep on a good deep throw by Ben, and bang, all of a sudden in 25 seconds, you're kicking a field goal with 5 seconds left. So really impressive there. Steelers did what they needed to do. They really toughened up defensively. It's surprising for how easily the Bengals moved the ball, Dave, that the Steelers defense, without Ryan Shazier, obviously, was able to do what it needed to do, benefited from a couple drops, a couple, you know, penalties along the way. But they, you know, holding the Bengals to 3 points, they now went two games. You know, in that first game, I think the Bengals ran 20 second half plays for 19 yards and no points. And in this game, I think the number was something like 17 plays for 85 yards and 3 points. Again, just impressive with Cam, you know, they benefited from the touchdown called back, no doubt, but did what they had to do. And, you know, we've seen this offense, you know, come up with big plays at big times, and they got enough of them in this one, with, you know, culminating with Antonio Brown's ridiculous catch in the end zone and then the last drive for the win.
I think one thing that stuck out to me, I think going back through the all 22 last night, when especially looking at the Steelers defense, is Tyler Matakevich did not have a great game at all. Once he got into the game, it wasn't just him. There were you know, some defensive linemen I thought pushed around a little bit, but gap integrity certainly wasn't that. Matakevich, not good. Boy, even early there. And you know, trust me, the Bengals knew who was in and out of the game. You know, obviously, from the time Ryan Shazier left the game, I don't have the official charting on this yet. Just sent the charts to my guys last night for them to fill in. But just in a general sense of going through the all 22. The Bengals went heavy personnel quite a bit in that game. Now, was that originally by design, or was it because, you know, they knew they were going to be able to get Matakevich and then ultimately Fort on the field? But Matakevich, Shazier, and LJ Fort combined played, let's see, 61 of 64 snaps. Now, you know, that's not all sub package snaps there, but in total, I'm willing to bet that the Steelers played, 15 to 16 sub package snaps. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is their base defense was probably on the field quite a bit for this game, because they wanted to try to isolate that bigger grouping, if you will, across from them. Now, one of the most noticeable plays, I think, right from the get-go when Matakevich is on the field, was the Bengals motioned a tight end over from right to left, and then just ran a simple RPO, run-pass option, and C.J. Uzomah, a guy, by the way, I liked him coming out of Auburn. I was hoping he would have ended up with the Steelers as an undrafted free agent. Releases straight up the field, uncovered. And we've seen the Steelers be able to run this before as well, too. You know, you line up heavy, you put the tight end on the end of the line of scrimmage, and depending on what the defense shows you, you either hand the ball off to the running back, your line automatically run blocks. You have a wide receiver on the edge that's running, you know, turns on kind of a bubble or a smoke screen, if you will, and then you have, you know, a guy off the end of the line of scrimmage released straight up the field. And that's what they did, and it was a very, very, very easy pitch and catch from Dalton to Uzomah. I think either first quarter, early second quarter there. That stuck out to me. Once again, the defense, there were just too many successful runs by Giovanni Bernard and really Joe Mixon while he was in the game there. Like we said the other day, the longest run was, 13 or 14 yards. It wasn't like they got gashed for explosiveness. It was just, you know, 5, 4, 5, 6, 7 yard runs all add up and end up leaving opposing offenses in very, very makeable down and distance situations. And in fact, what were the Bengals in that game, David? They were 7 of 14 on third downs. And I haven't gone back and looked at how many were longer than 7 yards, but I bet not too terribly many of them, especially not in, the first half. Offensively, man, when you got AB on the field, you can do so many things. And I really thought that he played a big part in this win, as did Le'Veon Bell. I thought the blocking for the most part throughout the game was okay by the Steelers' offensive line. Obviously, Ramon Foster kind of got caught napping on one of those sacks with a twist coming from the other side there. He should have been able to better pick that up, I thought, in my opinion there. But Le'Veon Bell, the yards per carry, probably not obviously what you would overall like, but boy, he sure was dishing out contact on the other end, whether it be via a run or via via reception. 21.2 yards per reception sure will help that average out, and then of course 35 yards that long touchdown will help in that help that average as well too. And his other runs, and I haven't gone through to see success versus non-success, but 4.2 yards per carry, definitely a little bit of an increase in just a raw stat there. And once again, his long was 16 yards. James Conner got 3 snaps in the game as well. Overall, not a bad performance by the Steelers offense, but I think that, one thing that we pointed out before the game, got to do better on third downs. And they were 4 of 12 on third downs, and they really didn't hit their stride until the second half. Weren't they something like 1 of 6 or something on third downs in the first half there? So special teams probably gets a D- or so, maybe even an F in that game. But those are really, after going back through the tape, those are my thoughts there.
Okay, we've covered most of it. And we'll hit a little bit more of it on Friday. By the way, just as a reminder, we'll have Chris Hoke will join us, Hokey Bro, on Friday. We want to get kind of a feel for just his thoughts on what's going on with player safety and the suspensions, and maybe kind of, what might have gone on in the locker room at halftime, what Mike Tomlin might have said, kind of his thoughts around how you deal with serious injuries for that, serious injuries like what happened with the Steelers Monday night. So be on the lookout for that on Friday. We're going to come back. We're going to talk some Ravens as we flip the switch quickly and get to John Eisenberg. Okay, it is Wednesday, and it's time for us to talk to a beat writer from the opposing team. And because it's Ravens week and the Steelers and Ravens, we'll get at it prime time Sunday night at Heinz Field. We've got our buddy John Eisenberg joining us from Ravens.com. You can follow John, as always, at B. Moore Eisenberg, E-I-S-E-N-B-E-R-G. John's most recent book is called The Streak, A History of Baseball's Iron Man Record, obviously focused on Cal Ripken. He's written a bunch of football books, one about what's happened down in Texas back in the day. And his book coming up next fall is called The League, and it will be focusing on early days of the NFL with, I am told, John, a fair bit of stuff about the Rooney family and what happened. And we look back and think of that as kind of the Wild West, and the stories about Art Rooney purchasing the Steelers are a bit legendary. So I'm sure a lot of our listeners look forward to seeing that.
Great. Thank you. Yeah, I'm loving doing that. I interviewed Dan Rooney before he passed away, and really enjoying the Pittsburgh segments. I think your listeners will be interested in this.
Okay, John, let's get into the blood war coming up on Sunday night. The Steelers, it was mentioned at the end of the broadcast, there is this kind of longstanding, AFC North football, physical, hard-nosed football. And back, I think, 5 or 10 years ago, there was an incredible level of animosity between the Steelers and their fan base and the Ravens and their fan base. And over time, that seems to have changed, and it really is personified in Terrell Suggs and Ben Roethlisberger to a very high level of respect and what's seen as good, hard football, whereas what the relationship between the Steelers and the Bengals has devolved into just, what's perceived as being really dirty, nasty, ugly football. Is that your perception of the situation in Baltimore, and how do you look at it all between, you know, these two teams, or these three teams, if you will?
Well, I think there is some truth to it. I mean, I did have to laugh. I was listening to the watching the broadcast like you were, and you know, they kept referring to it. You know, oh well, the Steelers and Ravens play. There's a healthy respect, and then he just went on and on about it. It was like they were going to church together or something. You know, I mean. You know, it was like, oh, they're the best friends, and it's wonderful between them. And it was like, well, let's talk to Hines Ward and Ed Reed about that. And, you know, let's talk to Joey Porter and Ray Lewis, and let's see how they feel about the other side. You know, it was at one point, it was not going to church together between those teams. you know, it has definitely calmed down. I do think, you know, there's respect. I mean, I think Mike Tomlin and John Harbaugh get along pretty well, and you know, as well as you can in this situation. And yeah, I think there is healthy respect, and it has changed. I think watching the Steelers and Bengals play is pretty shocking. I have to be honest with you. I mean, that was pretty rough stuff the other night. Not from my perspective as just a viewer, not attractive at all. And you know, did seem to kind of get out of hand, so I don't know. You know, I think AFC North football is great, level-headed, you know, hard-nosed football. I think this is one case where a rivalry does seem to have gotten out of hand. Otherwise, it's just, you know, AFC football, AFC North football. And, you know, I don't expect it to be like it was. This Sunday night, I don't expect it a reprise of what we saw on Monday night.
You got a team here that the Bengals had won whatever they did coming in 5 in a row. The Steelers now have won 7 in a row. The Ravens have won 3 in a row. I think a lot of people, and I think myself included, Dave less so, but I kind of buried the Ravens. And here they are at 7-5, certainly in control of their own destiny, as people like to say, their own fate in terms of making the playoffs, 4-1 in their last 5 games. Are they playing good football?
Well, I think they're starting to. I mean, there's definitely been a lot of question marks about them even as they started to win. They just kept playing backup quarterbacks one after the other. And, you know, they went into Green Bay and shut out the Packers with Brett Hundley. And you know, everybody kind of said, well, backup quarterback. Of course, then a week later, Hundley goes into Lambeau Field. And, you know, the Packers play an excellent game. Almost beat the Steelers. And so that shutout that the Ravens put forth, you know, looks a little better in hindsight. So what the Ravens are, you know, their defense is definitely playing at a playoff caliber and has, since they got Brandon Williams back and they've tightened up their run defense, the defense has been playing consistently well. Special teams are outstanding, if not the best in the league, very close. So it's all been on the offense, which has just been not good all year. And finally, on Sunday against the Lions, the offense looked good. I mean, Joe Flacco, who's not been much of a playmaker this year, made a bunch of plays. They ran the ball to the line, which has been patched together after injuries, blocked well, dominated Detroit. So, you know, there was an offense that was pretty productive. And so, you know, if you can have a productive offense on top of those, the other two units, you do have probably a pretty good football team. So, but, you know, it remains to be seen whether they can consistently move the ball and score like they did last week.
Before Dave gets in on you, I'll just throw in that, you know, we talk about both these offenses. On the season, the Steelers have scored 281 points and the Ravens have scored 280. So they've scored one more point than the Ravens on the season.
Yeah, I mean, that is very interesting. And, yeah, I mean, the Ravens have returned a bunch. They had a bunch of pick sixes. I mean, the defense has 4 or 5 touchdowns. So, and they got a great kicker. You know, they're always, you know, scoring drive is usually a short punt, 20 yards, and a field goal. That's a Ravens scoring drive.
So, I said, Justin Tucker, if I had to have one athlete do anything for my life, it would be Justin Tucker kick a 40-yard field goal.
Yeah, or 50. Listen, he's unbelievable. Right, he right. is just you know, they don't even blink, and it comes through. It's so important. It's so many points in a season and in a game. In this Detroit game last week, they were blowing that lead. The Ravens were. The Lions were coming after them, and the Ravens really needed to make it a 2-score game. And Tucker lines up a 51-yard field goal with like 7 minutes to play, and he clears the the crossbar by like 10 yards. I mean, it's just like, well, it's automatic. And other teams don't have that luxury. It's actually a huge thing when you're playing the Ravens is that they're in scoring range when you get to the 35-yard line. They're going to put points on the board.
They sure are. He's Mr. Automatic and has been for a long time. When you look at this offense, though, John, I watch a lot of them throughout the season. Alex, to me, Alex Collins is a very, very serviceable NFL running back. I think he's going to be around a little while. They obviously got Danny Woodhead back, who missed that game the last time around against the Steelers. I'm guessing Terrence West probably not going to be around too much longer. Javarius Allen, obviously, they're kind of a change of pace guy, if you will, but can run between the tackles additionally. I guess what I'm getting at is that, overall, the offense from a run game aspect to me hasn't been that bad this season. So has this just been, is this, for lack of better words, has this just been Joe Flacco not making plays? Now, obviously, the wide receiver group with this team is going to have to be overhauled during the offseason. Breshad Perriman's just still been a mess for them. Mike Wallace is Mike Wallace. And to me, Jeremy Maclin is more of a number two guy than anything else. But does this boil down to whether or not Joe Flacco makes plays during the game, or how much of the offensive line is in that?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a lot of issues right there. And the one thing they've done fairly well, not totally consistently, but fairly well, is, as you said, run the ball. And what's happened was the defense has been so good, has forced so many turnovers, and they've gotten ahead in games, is that they've just run out the clock, basically, in a bunch of games. Once they've gotten ahead, they've been really good at protecting leads. And the offensive line, which is completely pieced together. I mean, they have undrafted free agents at guard. They have a first-year starter at center. And, people thought, well, this season's over when Marshall Yanda went down. But, after 9 or 10 weeks here of, they are playing better and they can run the ball. So, and Alex Collins, as you pointed out, I mean, who would think that one of the biggest things to happen to the Ravens this year is that the Seahawks cut a guy named Alex Collins that no one had heard of. And he has been quite serviceable as a running back, and he's the number one guy. And so they can run the ball, they will do that. The passing game has just been a problem, and it's at the eternal debate here. Is it Flacco? Is it the receivers? Is it the protection? It's all of that. Flacco has been inaccurate, has thrown off his back foot some, just has made some bad decisions and has just not been consistent. But, everyone has seen it before. He can turn it on. And his receivers have dropped passes. I mean, Breshad Perriman is looking like a bust, to be honest. And Mike Wallace, he's made some big plays. And Maclin has been sort of average. So, whether it all comes together, I don't know. But if Flacco, the guys are open enough. And if Flacco's on his game and playing better, generally the passing game's going to be pretty good. So, I think it does boil down to him. And if he's playing better. And he loves to play in Pittsburgh. He's the first one to say that. So it should be interesting Sunday night.
Do you expect, and this really isn't related to this week's game, more of next season or off season, do you expect them to draft a wide receiver, a tight end, and an offensive lineman within the first five picks of theirs in the draft?
Well, one would hope so. I mean, they didn't draft any offensive players this year. In the first four rounds, I think it was. And so the first 2 days at least. And so, and they've gotten a lot of criticism for that, and they've paid the price for it. And so, whether they draft a receiver here, it's a hot button issue in Baltimore. They've never drafted a first round receiver who's done well. So, but I don't think you can stop firing bullets there. You gotta keep going. You need these guys and they desperately need a young guy. So yeah, I expect them to do that. When healthy, they've got a pretty good line between Alex Lewis they found at left guard. He's out for the year. Yanda is one of the best linemen in the league, is at right guard. Ryan Jensen, they think they found a center. He's been pretty good, but he is a free agent after this year. Ronnie Stanley's very solid at left tackle, and Austin Howard they signed at right tackle. That's a pretty good line if healthy. So they're not as worried about that as much as they are as the playmakers. And so a receiver, a tight end, definitely. And they could really upset the apple cart and draft a quarterback. How about that? That would be interesting around here.
Yeah, that would, absolutely. And we had that conversation and have a lot more of that in Pittsburgh as well. John, you know, you look, and let's just say because the game's in Pittsburgh, the Steelers are able to win this game, and the Ravens go to 7-6, but they finish at Cleveland and then with Indy and Cincinnati at home. I mean, it is absolutely realistic to talk about this being a 10-win Ravens team. And then, you know, obviously as a wild card, they're going to go on the road in the first round of the playoffs. But, you know, a dangerous wild card team. What's the reaction? I'm just curious kind of what the reaction of the fan base has been over the course of this season. I can't imagine 3 weeks ago anybody was looking at this team as a dangerous playoff team, let alone a Super Bowl contender. Just, you know, the thought of where they're going to make the playoffs. And now, you know, I think people are realistically looking at the defense, and Dave's been pointing it out all year long that, you know, this team, you know, this is a team somebody might not want to play in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, 3 weeks ago, the question was, I mean, can a team with, like, no offense, you know, be a playoff contender? And I think most of the fans here were pretty dubious, pretty skeptical, and we're tired of watching the you know, football that was not very exciting, and an offense that with three and outs, you know, they were tired of looking at it. It's been a fairly negative year, I would say, among the fan base. So this latest turnaround, you know, is, again, it's the defense leading the way, but you can sort of see some hope. And so, yeah, I think it's gotten people going a little bit, but I think people remain skeptical. However, as you pointed out, I mean, with the schedule that they have, I mean, they really should make the playoffs. It's not a could, it's a should.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an easy ending schedule. So if they don't make it, you know, I don't know what'll happen. There's going to be a lot of disappointment. But 10-6, they're in, I'm sure. And, yeah, they would probably go play, let's say they go down and play Jacksonville in the first round. Jacksonville killed them in London this year. But, you know, here come the Ravens with a Super Bowl winning quarterback, an outstanding defense, and a Super Bowl winning coach against, you know, Blake Bortles. And
yeah, sure.
A Jacksonville team that is excited just to be there. So the Ravens, I think, in that situation, very dangerous. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting scenario that's unfolding.
John, we obviously get to talk to you all the time. And rather than me, you know, go through specifics on the defense, why don't you just tell us who's playing well? I mean, look, it's a as we've mentioned, it's a high caliber defense. What's new? What's the surprise? Who stood out?
Well, since the last game, I mean, when the Steelers came to Baltimore and just ran over them, just handed the ball to Le'Veon Bell and ran over him. Brandon Williams was not on the field then, and certainly the Steelers took advantage of that. He's the run stopper that they paid a bunch of money to in the offseason. He has been back for a month, and the run defense has tightened up a lot since then. I mean, that's not to say that Bell won't still go for a lot of yards. He seems to always do that, but it will be much tougher going with Brandon Williams in the middle for the Ravens. So that's really the key to it. You know, again, it's a situation where they've had a bunch of injuries. They got a blend of old and new that's playing well. I mean, Terrell Suggs is having an excellent year. Best year in several. He's really getting after the quarterback pretty well this year. He's holding the edge. He's playing three down. I mean, there have been times when they've been taking him off the field the last few years. He's a three down guy this year. So pretty impressive to watch. And on the other side, they have found someone. Matthew Judon has been a pretty good pass rusher, and they've gotten sacks from a variety of sources. Judon is second after Suggs. The defensive coordinator, Dean Pease, is real good at dialing up pressures, and so safeties and different people are coming up with things. But the main guys on defense, I mean, C.J. Mosley in the middle of the linebackers having an outstanding year, and Eric Weddle at safety is having an excellent year. I mean, of course, they're now without Jimmy Smith, their best cornerback, who tore his Achilles last Sunday. That's the headline story around here. This week, and you know, the good news for the Ravens is that injury, Smith is injury prone, and he's had prior injuries that have pretty much ended their seasons because they couldn't replace him. But this year, they're better equipped to do it. They have Brandon Carr, who they signed in the offseason. He's been solid, and they have their first-round draft pick, Marlon Humphrey, who's they really like, and he'll be the guy replacing Smith. And you know, he's a pretty good player, even as a rookie. And so I think they feel like they're better equipped to handle the loss of Smith going forward.
Yeah, and plus Jimmy Smith, in defense of Jimmy Smith, I thought, you know, he was battling that Achilles, I think, most of the season. But he still, I thought, you know, with making some plays, having a decent season. But as you said, with Marlon Humphrey has gotten some playing time throughout the season. They're not gonna have Marlon follow any. They stay on their sides over there for the most part, right? So in other words, it's gonna be Carr on the left side, Marlon Humphrey on the right side, and you know, I suspect you'll see Ladarius Webb and nickel, and if they go any kind of dime type stuff, probably Maurice Kennedy, who missed a good chunk of the season early on, is back in the fold now. So I mean, really, which one do you try to attack with AB, or does it matter? I mean, we saw AB play on nine toes against the Bengals, and it looked like he had 12 toes.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure it matters. I mean, he's great, and the way he tore them apart last year in the fourth quarter had a lot to do with how they reconfigured their team this year. So it will be interesting to see. It's a group effort back there. One thing, Maurice Kennedy, he's moved ahead of Webb, I think, as the nickel guy. Okay. You're going to see more of Kennedy. He's a second year guy. He's been hurt a lot. I think he might be a steal as a sixth round pick. He's playing a lot. He's playing pretty well. And, so that's another guy they're going to factor in there. No, they'll just line it up and whatever. I mean, with Jimmy Smith, Jimmy was having his best season. He very few. DeAndre Hopkins had some success against him on the Monday night game, and really that was really the only game where he was giving up anything. That side of the field was pretty much shut down this year with Jimmy. So it'll be a little different scenario in that backfield, and I expect the Steelers to go both ways. But I don't know. We'll see. I mean, they've given up some yards. The way the secondary, Baltimore secondary works, they do give up some catches, they do give up some yards, they do pick you off usually about twice a game. So it's very interesting back there. And in the end, you know, it's pretty tough sledding for opponents. So just a really fun matchup at this point.
Excluding Brandon Williams, Terrell Suggs, C.J. Mosley, and, of course, Eric Weddle, everybody knows. I mean, if they don't know about those four guys by now, they haven't turned on a TV in a while. Who is the most underrated of the group that's healthy and seeing significant playing time right now? Would it be Matthew Judon?
Well, Judon, yeah, I guess, although, you know, John Gruden was all over him on the Monday night game and talking about a great young player and all this. I would say this really underrated unknown is this defensive tackle, Willie Henry, who has just completely come out of nowhere and was a fourth-round pick a year ago, basically didn't play as a rookie, and I wasn't even sure he's going to make the team. He finally gets a chance. Brent Urban goes down. And then when Brandon Williams was out, they put him in there, and all he's done is stop the run and make plays. He's very active. He rushes the passer. They traded Timmy Jernigan, who's done well in Philadelphia, but Willie Henry is like doing the same thing that he's playing better than Jernigan did here. So this is a guy that's just come completely out of nowhere, number 69, and has played very good football for them. And, you know, I mean, the Ravens, they don't draft wide receivers like the Steelers do in the fourth round, who turn out to be great. They draft defensive linemen, you know, that's what they do. So you draft a lot of them. They don't all turn out, but, you know, they always seem to find one. And here's another one.
Okay, John, put you on the spot. Again, this game is – you know, look, it's meaningful always. It's the Steelers can clinch the AFC North, but it's not a must-win game for the Steelers. In reality, it's not really a must-win game for the Ravens. I'm sure emotions will be high, national television. Can the Ravens – look, they can do enough. Do you think the Ravens will come in and win in Pittsburgh?
I think they're really in a good position to do it. just because I, they do have more to play for. I mean, you're right in that. I mean, yeah, they can lose this game and go forward. And but by the same token, Steelers can lose the game, right? And if they beat New England the next week, they still get the number one seed, right? I mean, so I think it's kind of a funny game that way. But the Ravens, I mean, they're far. They got more catching up to do. And they, if they win this game, I mean, most people are expecting them to lose, understandably. If they were to win this game, it changes everything for them. Everything. It's like they go from being kind of a ho-hum team to, if they can go into Pittsburgh and win, then they might be for real. So I think they have more to play for. And, you know, they seem to be on a roll of a kind. So, yeah, I think they have a real chance of doing it. I could easily see them coming in and winning.
Dave, anything to close this out with?
No. I think, I mean, he's hit on it there. How about a score prediction? Our listeners always like those. Rattle their cage a little bit.
Okay. How about – let's have a weird score. 22-19 Baltimore. Field goals and God knows what. 22-19 John, Baltimore.
John, always great fun to talk to you. You know, we look forward to these annual get-togethers or biannual get-togethers, and now we get you in the preseason and the draft as well. So good fun talking to you, and we will be looking forward to the book. And look, maybe we'll get a chance to do this again sometime in January.
That would be great. That's these games are always the most fun. I look forward to it. So thanks for having me on, as always.
Okay, Dave, as always, good stuff from John. And, yeah, look, this Ravens team, when you have a good offensive week, as when the Steelers did that kind of for a half and then another game, all of a sudden the expectations continue to get ramped up. I do think their fan base has been not sleeping on this team, just disappointed with how they got to the middle of the season. And now, look, they've won four out of five and three in a row. So he's right. If they come in and beat Pittsburgh, that will, in a nationally televised game, that will put the Ravens in the conversation then with the teams, whether you want to put it the Steelers and the Patriots and everybody else or the Patriots and everybody else, it'll put the Ravens squarely in that conversation.
Hey, you know, even if Pittsburgh wins this game, and of course, if they do, they will clinch the AFC North in the process. But, you know, if the Ravens lose, David, their final three games are against the Browns, the Colts, and the Bengals. I mean, those are three games that they should win, right? I mean, so, you know, 9, you know, what would that put them? Possible at 10-6, you know, and look, if they beat
to look, if they would beat the Steelers, they could run the table here and finish with what? 7 in a row. So, you know, they could, if they beat the Steelers, they could certainly go 11-5 because they get 2 at home and Cleveland on the road. That's not, you know, the Bengals and the Colts at home and Cleveland on the road. That's about as easy as it gets. The Bengals aren't going to have anything to play for.
So in other words, I mean, regardless, I think, of what happens in this game Sunday night, I'm going to be shocked that the Ravens are not in the playoffs. And the question becomes then, is this a team that could – if there is a team that might be built to maybe – you know, jump on the Patriots, maybe it's them. And of course the Jaguars in that defense as well too. Obviously Joe Flacco's more experienced when it comes to playoffs and all. Now if they can get that off, we'll see what that offense has to bring in the final quarter of the season, if you will, talking about the Ravens but look, I mean, this is a team with that defense I've been talking about all year. You know, they're not going to be an easy out during the playoffs here. And I don't know, Dave, I'm starting to get a sneaky feeling that this game Sunday night might be the second of three this year between these two teams. But obviously got some time to worry about that. We'll get busy on Friday breaking down this game a little bit more. Not that we'll be bringing a lot of new information to this, being as how these teams play each other, so, you know, at least twice a year. One quick note I wanted to get to on, you know, people are asking about Cameron Sutton and saying, you know, how did Cameron Sutton play in that game against the Bengals? angles. I haven't gone snap by snap on that. I've just done my brief overview of the all 22 in that game. And keep in mind, folks, that Cameron Sutton only played 24 snaps in that game, and he wasn't targeted too terribly often in that game. I think the big thing that probably might stick out in the mind of a lot of people was that called back touchdown. And if you go back, and I put an animated GIF of that one up on my Twitter feed as well, too. You know, that looks like a cover one, all right? It looks like Cameron Sutton's job is to run green to the middle of the field. And he does that. And you have to kind of wonder what Robert Golden is thinking and what his job is on that play, because really it's only, you know, it was a three-man route, but essentially a two-man route down the field there. And the other route's coming from the left side, and it's an over route. And, you know, it kind of gets passed off from Artie Burns to, you know, one of the underneath zone guys, if you will. And Golden is kind of keying on that and not on the lone vertical route. And that gives you kind of pause there. And the way Cameron Sutton kind of plays that, in my opinion, leads me to believe that he was expecting to have some help in the middle of the field there. Now,
yeah, the only thing that caught me on that is the way the linebacker on the left side dropped into the flat. And if he was, you know, getting that covering that area, you wonder if Sutton had some deep responsibility in, you know, we can talk about whether it's thirds or whatever it was, but if he was supposed to, the way the linebacker dropped into the flat, I was surprised Sutton didn't give the receiver more of a cushion. Now, it doesn't negate anything you just said about expecting to have help over the top. It was just, I don't know if it was, it didn't look like Bud Dupree, but maybe it was Bud Dupree. But it just, the coverage looked odd the way Sutton played it, the way it resulted with Sutton playing it, with the linebacker dropping and Golden not being there. So, yeah, I'm curious to know exactly how that went as well.
Yeah, the way he cushions and the way he aligns with the outside leverage, you know, it looks like he's playing, you know, cover one there. Now, should he have played off or did Dupree drop extremely kind of deep on that side? Really, there was nothing really to drop to, right? I mean,
right.
You could argue that because there was nobody on that side, that Bud's job was to gain as much depth as possible on that play, right? So, and he did that. It did also look like he was funneling green to the middle of the field as well. Look, that's a tough chore. If you allow inside release there, I mean that's tough to expect a guy to run, right? I mean, you know, he's paid to do it, obviously. Should he have been able to run a little bit closer? You know, that's an argument there as well, too. So it's hard really to put a finger on how much a responsibility goes where. But, boy, Robert Golden sure does seem keen on wanting that over route over the middle more so than – and, you know, look, if you look at the end zone on the all-22 – Golden kind of raises his hands up as well, too, after the throw and catch is made. So that gives you some pause on that aspect. Overall, and I'll go play-by-play with this probably later on tonight, I thought Sutton did okay. You know, I tell you one thing that did stick out about Cody Sensabaugh early in that game outside of his coverage. He was going down and helping out with a run, okay? So you got to give him that. He was sticking his face in the fan and doing everything that you would kind of want one of your outside corners to do there. Now, obviously, when it came to coverage, he wasn't close on a lot of those throws and completions before getting yanked from that game there. So it will be interesting to see what happens in this game. You know, Sunday night against the Ravens, if Sutton starts, you know, who he's going to see on that side. You know, obviously, they're going to stay on their sides. I wouldn't expect, all of a sudden for those guys to start flipping sides or anything like that. But, you know, are guys like Macklin and Wallace a great test anyway, or a great warm up to what they'll face the week after in the game against the Patriots there. So I'll go more snap by snap by that on the tape, talking about Sutton later on tonight, and I'll give you a report on that on Friday podcast. Upon us kind of previewing more about what's going to happen with Steelers and Ravens, and we'll of course get into our weekly picks. And as David said, we'll talk to Chris Hoke as well. And I really look forward to that. So it should be an action packed show on Friday. And in the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. You can follow David Todd on the Twitter machine at David M. Todd. You can follow the show at Terrible Podcast. You can email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. We got one from overseas this week, David, did we not? Someone from Germany, was it?
Germany, yeah. Just got an email from Germany earlier today. So,
Karsten Schinke, I think. Karsten, we from Hamburg City. That's where they invented a hamburger, isn't it, David?
Hamburg. I've been to Hamburg, actually.
It's Hamburg. What's that? I'll gladly pay you a tomorrow for a Hamburg today.
Hamburg today. Wimpy. Oh, is that Wimpy?
Yeah, it is Wimpy. Yeah, it is Wimpy. Okay, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and you want to donate to the cause, please go to SteelersDepot.com. Hit that donate button up right navigational bar. Boy, I got hungry for a hamburger there. David, have a great day. I'll talk to you on Friday.
As always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.